So I'm going to speak today about something that's, about how quantum information is localized in quantum gravity. And before I start, let me just take a minute to acknowledge my collaborators, because I'm going to speak about work done in collaboration with many people. So the work that I'm going to speak about started with this paper that we wrote with Alok, Siddharth, and Pushkal last year, and then a follow-up with Chandramouli and Olga, who's actually at PI, and another follow-up with Chandramouli, Olga, and Victor, and also a couple of papers that we wrote with what we call the Group of Seven, which is Hao, Andreas, Carlos, Lisa, Marcos, and Sanjeet. So a couple of papers that we wrote here, and then this there's a longish review that I wrote last year, and this talk is actually going to be structured on an essay that I put out last month, which is this one if you'd like to see more details. So the main theme of this talk and the main message that I'm going to try and convey is that in a theory of quantum gravity, quantum information is localized very differently than it is in non-gravitational theories. And I'll try and explain what I mean by that. And the second part of this talk is going to be to explore the consequences of this difference for the black hole information paradox. And I'll try and persuade you that this difference between how gravity and other theories localize information is an important aspect of the information paradox. So the overview of this, the outline of this talk is pretty simple. It's just two parts. The first part is about the failure of the split property, and the second part is about the implications of this failure for black holes. So let me start by first just explaining what I mean by the split property, which might be an unfamiliar term in non-gravitational theories. So imagine that you have some non-gravitational theory like this lattice theory. Then it's a very basic fact about this theory that, if you just think about it at one point of time, you can specify the state inside some bounded region, like this region that's shaded in pink, and outside that region independently. So, I could, for instance, like I have done in these two pictures, flip this pin from being up to being down, and I could independently do whatever I like on the set of states outside. This won't be necessarily the ground state. This may not even be an energy eigenstate. But if you just said, is there a valid state in which I can do whatever I like inside and whatever I like outside, then there is a valid state. And in fact, this corresponds to the fact that, in this kind of a lattice theory, the Hilbert space of the theory factorizes into a part that's inside, that's associated with the region inside some bounded region, and a subfactor that's associated with the region outside some bounded region, which is this yellow region here. So there is an analog of this in continuum theories, and the analog of this property is called the split property. And this is a very basic property of non-gravitational theories. And the way it's framed is as follows, imagine that you have some bounded region, which is this blue region, R. And we don't have a lattice, but what you need to do is you surround R with a small collar region, which is this white region, epsilon. And then you look at the complement of both this region R and the collar, which is denoted here by R bar. And all of this is happening on a single Cauchy slice. So, unless I specify otherwise, everything I'm saying here is just about valid states in the theory. So you specify states at a single instant of time. And so there's just some division I've made of a spatial slice at a single instant of time. Then the split property, which is the precise version of the statement that the Hilbert space factorizes in a lattice regularization, is the statement that if I give you any two states in the Hilbert space, which I can call psi 1 and psi 2, then I can find for you a third state, which is called a split state, which is the state psi, which has the property that if you look at correlation functions in the state psi of some insertions of local operators inside the region, as you see here, phi x1 to maybe phi xn, and some insertions of local operators in the region outside, which is phi y1 to phi ym, then this correlation function is given by the correlation function in the state psi 1 of these local operators inside, so phi x1 to phi xn evaluated in the state psi 1, and correlators of the local operators outside in the state psi 2. So that's the statement that for all effects and purposes, for an observer who's confined to outside this bounded region, the state looks like Psi 2. And for an observer who's confined to making observations inside the bounded region, the state looks like the state Psi 1. And as I said, this is the analog of the statement that the Hilbert space factorizes in a lattice regularization. So here is a cartoon version of the same thing that I said, and you can keep this in mind if you like. So the split property is the statement that, you know, I can prepare a state which looks exactly like the vacuum in outside some bounded region, and then I can create some excitation inside the region, like this bump here, and there's no way for observers outside here to know that there is an excitation inside. As I said, and I emphasize again, this is about a single time slice. Of course, you know, if the observers here wait for some time, things will evolve and the excitation will move outside and then they will know about it. But we are just talking here about states. And so not only can you prepare a state here, which looks exactly like the vacuum outside or like some other state outside and has some excitation inside, you can prepare a second state where you change the form of the excitation inside this region while you kept this part outside the region completely unchanged. Okay? And this is just a very basic property of quantum field theories. In fact, it's so basic that one of the reasons perhaps some of you have not heard about this mentioned is because we just take it for granted. And it's very key to the idea that information is localized in a QFT inside some region, and it's not available outside its complement. For instance, in this cartoon, you see that the information about the shape of this bump is not available to observers outside, for whom all correlators look exactly like the vacuum. And they need to either visit, you know, this region inside, or they need to wait for light rays to emerge in order for that information to emerge. So this is just a very simple property of QFTs. Now, what I'm going to tell you is that in a theory of gravity, this is not the case. Gravity does not localize information in this manner. And in fact, it does something very different. And the statement in gravity, which we call the principle of holography of information, is that if you have some information that's available in the bulk of a Cauchy slice, so you might have some bits or some qubits that are available in the bulk of the Cauchy slice, then the same information is also available near the boundary of the Cauchy slice. So there are some correlators which might be very complicated, something you might need to do, make very complicated observations, but there is some observation you can make at infinity which tells you about the state of these bits or qubits in the bulk of the Cauchy slice. So just to contrast that with the quantum field theory picture, remember I said that in a non-gravitational quantum field theory, you could prepare the state which, you know, looked like some excited state inside the region and looked like the vacuum outside, and then you could change the excitation and still keep the vacuum outside. But the first point is that in gravity, you can't even prepare such a state. So if you do prepare some excitation outside, then you have to have a tail in the wave function that extends out to infinity. But it's not just that you need to have a tail and you can't make the outside look like the vacuum. The claim is stronger. It is that if you change the form of this excitation inside this region, so you know, you change the shape of this bump, you're forced to change also the form of this tail. So there is a one-to-one correspondence between, you know, what kind of excitation you put inside and the tails at infinity. And that's so strong that you can read off from the tails at infinity what the state in the Cauchy slice is. So it's very different from the way non-gravitational quantum field theories localize information. Now, let me, before I'll say something more precise, but before that, let me just try and give you, you know, 5 minutes of just very elementary physics reason for why you might believe that gravity has such a property. So, you know, why would you even start to believe that, you know, there's something so funny in gravity? Okay. So let's just go back to something really elementary, which, you know, we learn at the beginning of our physics careers, which is just the uncertainty principle. And the uncertainty principle tells us that, you know, if you think of a state which is localized in energy, so it talks about momentum and position, but, you know, in theory of relativity, momentum comes together with energy. So if you think of a wave function which is very sharply peaked at some energy, then this wave function is completely delocalized in position space. So what I have on the left-hand side is some S wave that corresponds to this energy. I could give it some other angular momentum, but it would always extend out to infinity. So this is just a basic property of quantum mechanics. Of course, this does not prevent us in a non-gravitational theory from creating localized excitations. And the way we do that is by superposition. So we take, you know, one wave function, which is localized at one energy. We add to it another wave function, which is localized at a different energy with the right kind of phase. We add to it a third different wave function, which is localized at a third different energy with the right kind of phase. And if you keep going on to infinity in this way, you don't need to add an infinite number of components. You can arrange that in position space, all of these wave functions interfere destructively outside a bounded region, and they interfere constructively inside a bounded region. So by adding up these wave functions, which are peaked at different energies, you can get some wave function that in position space looks like this. And I emphasize again that this is all happening at one time. Of course, if you wait for time to evolve, then this wave function will disperse, but at a single time slice, you can get a wave function that does this. Okay, so why would this not work in a theory of gravity? So what is different about gravity is something, again, very elementary, and I'll explain why this plays such an important role. And it's the fact that gravity obeys a Gauss law. Okay? So the Gauss law is, you know, of course, is familiar to us just from Newtonian gravity. And it tells us that, you know, if you measure the gravitational flux in a Gaussian sphere at infinity, then you can measure the mass inside. But there is an analog of the Gauss law, of course, in general relativity. And the expression you see on the screen in front of you is the expression for the ADM Hamiltonian, which tells you that, you know, to determine the energy of some state, one should go out to infinity and look at the subleading deviations of the metric away from flat space and integrate them on the sphere at infinity. And that tells you the energy inside. Not only is this a definition of the energy in general relativity, this is the definition of the energy in general relativity. We don't have a good local definition of the energy. And this is the way the energy is defined in a theory of gravity. In general relativity, and also when you quantize gravity. Okay, so you might say, fine, you know, we knew that as well. And so what does that have to do with the localization of information? So the main physical point is that, think back to the state that I said was sharply peaked in energy, and you had this S wave function that extended out to infinity. Now, in the theory of gravity, this state does not exist by itself. It does not exist by itself because, you know, you must satisfy the Gauss law. And the way you must satisfy the Gauss law is that at the least, you must, you know, there's in fact an infinite set of constraints that go by the name of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. But at the least, you see that, you know, you must have, together with the state, a tail at infinity, you must have another component of the wave functional that tells you that the metric at infinity takes on a certain form so that, you know, when you integrate it on the sphere at infinity, you get the energy that corresponds to this wave function in position space. So in the quantum theory, each excitation that you write down must be dressed with a gravitational tail. So the point is, if you now try to play the game that, you know, we played earlier, where you try to add together these wave functions which are peaked at a different energy, so you just try to add together the wave functions so as to get a localized excitation, you now find that each of these wave functions comes together with a separate gravitational tail. So this is on the left-hand side, you have some dynamical excitation, which is peaked at a given at some energy. And on the right-hand side, you have some tail that corresponds to it, which is some degree of freedom of the metric. And then, you know, in this, when you look at a wave function with a different energy, that is necessarily correlated with a different value for this tail at infinity. And these tails are visible at infinity. And the main physical point is that if you now try to play the game that you played in ordinary quantum mechanics, where you tried to add together these wave functions so as to get destructive interference outside a bounded region, but constructive interference inside a bounded region, these tails prevent that from happening. And I emphasize, it is not just that the information is visible in the tails. You know, you might have, and you do have, degenerate energy eigenstates. So you might have two states which have exactly the same energy, you know, which have therefore exactly the same tail, but it is correlators of the energy and other observables that carry information about the state. So, you know, you could take states of the same energy, but that would never give you a localized state. So you have to superpose states of different energies, and it's therefore, you know, correlators of energy and other observables that tell you about the state. So this is not a proof, but this is, in fact, you know, this is a very simple physical way of understanding the effects that I'm going to describe. So, you know, even though it sounds like it's very elementary, it is actually useful intuition to keep in mind for the rest of the talk. Okay, So having given you that, you know, a very simple intuition, let me now make a more precise statement. So one of the precise, so we can make, you know, we can make this intuition precise in several settings. One setting in which we can make this precise is in four-dimensional asymptotically flat space. And there, you know, consider a four-dimensional asymptotically flat space and think of the set of all massless excitations. You know, we will soon have something to say about massive excitations, but for now, the result I'm going to describe is just for massless excitations. So think of the set of all massless excitations. In general, you know, what you see here on the screen is what's called a Penrose diagram, where I've brought in infinity to some finite region. And what you have on top is future null infinity, and this is past null infinity, this line below. And in general, to specify the state of all massless particles, you need to specify data either on all of future null infinity or on all of past null infinity. So both past and future null infinity function as, you know, limits of Cauchy slices for massless particles. And the statement is that in a theory of gravity, all this information is present near the boundary of the slice, as I said. And that's in the case of future null infinity, its past boundary, which is this region shaded in red, or this is in one higher dimension, or in the case of past null infinity, its future boundary. So in fact, every statement I make for future null infinity will have an analog for past null infinity. So for the remainder of this talk, I'll just keep talking about future null infinity, but just keep in mind that, you know, everything has an analog for past null infinity, but I won't duplicate myself. So let me just explain what I just said in a little more detail. So, you know, let's think of massless particles in a non-gravitational theory. Okay? So in non-gravitational theory, here is future null infinity and here is past null infinity. So as I said, let's just talk about future null infinity. You know, you can specify positions in future null infinity in terms of a retarded time, and so which I'll denote by U. And this retarded time runs from minus infinity near what's called the past boundary of future null infinity to plus infinity in this future boundary of future null infinity. And in a non-gravitational theory, to specify the state of all massless particles, what you would need to do is you would need to take the state and you would need to tell me all correlators of observables on null infinity for all values of this retarded time going from minus infinity to infinity. And if you did that, that would uniquely specify the state of the theory. Okay. Now, the claim is that in a gravitational theory, you do not need to specify correlators for all values of retarded time. But if you specify correlators for this limited range of retarded time, which is just the range of retarded time from minus infinity to minus one over epsilon, that is already sufficient to specify the state psi. So if you tell me the value of these correlation functions, there is a unique extension of these correlation functions to all of future null infinity. And it is not that you can specify these correlators in one way and correlators in the rest of future null infinity in another way. So you see that this realizes in a precise sense the intuition, you know, the result that I mentioned earlier, which is that the data that's available on all of a Cauchy slice is in fact available on its boundary. And here you see that, you know, so this region, which you can think of as being near the boundary of future null infinity, contains data of all of future null infinity. Okay, I'm not actually going to take you through the proof, although if there's some interest, I'm happy to go through it later. I do have some slides on that, and I'm happy to go through it in the discussion. But let me just make some comments about this result. So as I said, the result is that in a theory of gravity, you know, the state is completely determined by correlators in this little red interval. So this is a non-perturbative result. And you might ask, you know, how did we come to such a non-perturbative result, given that we don't know the full theory of gravity in asymptotically flat space? We don't understand how to, you know, do string theory in non-perturbatively in four-dimensional asymptotically flat space. And the answer is that, you know, this result relies only on weak assumptions about the full ultraviolet theory. And the specific assumptions that we need to prove this result are just the fact that the Hamiltonian remains positive, and second, that the vacuum can be identified by a boundary term in the full theory. So this is, in fact, you know, the version of the Gauss law that we need, which is the fact that, you know, you can measure the energy at infinity. And so in a theory of gravity, and I point out only in a theory of gravity, there is an observable at infinity that you can measure to determine whether you're in the vacuum or not. And these assumptions, which certainly hold in the low energy theory, if they're shared by the UV theory of gravity, are sufficient for us to establish this result. So the way one should think of this result is that any UV completion of the low energy theory that obeys these, what we think are weak assumptions, will also obey this property of holography of information. So as I said, I could take you through the proof if there's interest, but I thought I would do something else in this in the colloquium, and that's the following. You see, in this result that I mentioned is, as I said, a non-perturbative result, but one of its interesting aspects is that it's not just some formal non-perturbative result, which, you know, which doesn't have any relevance for anything we can think about in reality, but rather one can check this result in perturbation theory for a set of simple states. So I emphasize that what I'm going to say in the next few slides works only for a set of simple states, it's for a simple class of states, but nevertheless, I think it's illuminating and tells us, will help to explain many essential aspects of this result. So the problem I'm going to set myself and solve is the following. So imagine, you know, we have some observers, here are my friendly observers, these figures, and they're confined to making observations on this part of null infinity, which is the red part, okay? And imagine that we put them in some state, which is the state F, which is the following state. You act with a unitary operator with some profile, which is localized near the middle of null infinity. So it's localized somewhere near u retarded time equal to zero, and you act on the vacuum with such an operator. So if you think about what this operator is doing, it's creating for you in the bulk some kind of a shock wave. So it's like, you know, some bomb or some shock wave of massless particles that went off in the middle of space here. And that's going to come, that's strictly localized, you know, in a non-gravitational theory, it's strictly localized, and it's going to come and hit null infinity in the middle somewhere here, okay? And the challenge I'm going to set my friendly experimenters is, you know, I said that you could determine the state using correlators near the past boundary. So I'm going to say, you know, let's do perturbative correlators near the past boundary of null infinity, and do that and determine for me what the profile of the shock wave was. Let me point out that this is just obviously impossible in a non-gravitational theory. And that's because this is a unitary operator. So because it's a unitary operator, it just commutes with every observation these observers can make in a non-gravitational theory. And so there's nothing these people could do in the absence of gravity that could help them solve this challenge. But in the theory of gravity, it turns out for this set of states to be rather simple to solve this challenge. And the answer is the following. Our observers measure the two-point function of the energy, which in this case is given by the limit of an observable Condor Bondi mass. It's just a component of the metric at infinity. So that's what is m of minus infinity. So it's some component of the metric, and a correlation function of the same operator that created the state, but now inserted in this range u in minus infinity to minus one over epsilon. So they measure a two-point function of the metric and this observable, and it's a very simple calculation to see that this two-point function is not zero. Rather, it picks up a value, and the value it picks up depends on this profile of the shock wave, and it's this. So the shock wave, I remind you, has support only between retarded time u equal to zero to one, but this correlation function has support in the range u being minus infinity to minus one over epsilon. And this is the support that this correlation function has. And the reason this happens is, I remind you of the intuition I mentioned earlier, that the shock wave was really it was a superposition of different energy eigenstates. So it wasn't one energy eigenstate. So it looked like it was localized, but really it was a superposition of different energy eigenstates. And those different energy eigenstates talk in different ways to this metric at the boundary. And therefore, when you look at this correlation function of the metric, which you can measure by the Gauss law, and this observable, you find that this correlation function picks up a non-trivial value. In fact, if you look at this expression, you can see, you know, that this expression is just analytic if you extend it in the upper half plane. So if you know this correlator in the range minus infinity to minus one over epsilon, that's sufficient to reconstruct the state F, but you don't need a formal argument. You can just reconstruct it by looking at the moments. You know, if I'm allowed to measure this correlator in the range minus infinity to minus one over epsilon, just by looking at different powers of U, I'm allowed to vary U in that range. So I can extract different powers of U. I can pull out all the moments of this function f, and if I pull out a suitable number of moments, that's sufficient to give me the function f to any accuracy. For instance, you know, if I had two different potential shock waves, one with the yellow, one with the blue, here you just see a trivial numerical thing, you pull out 50 moments, you can easily distinguish between these similar shock waves. And you can keep going to any accuracy that you need. And so you see that these experimenters are able to solve this problem in the simple state of determining the profile of the shock wave before the shock wave actually hits null infinity. Okay, so let me now, the example is useful because it helps to, you know, bring out many things. For one, it helps to bring out the absence of gravity. You know, one of the things that some of you are perhaps thinking is, you know, in gauge theories as well, there's a Gauss law. But why doesn't this work in gauge theories?
Last question. So,
is it which? Yes.
Is it important what happens with this shockwave before it kind of originates from the center? Or this calculation is completely insensitive to this?
No, it's just a state. So, it doesn't care about, you know, these observers are placed in the state. And then they're allowed to measure correlators in the state. So there is a history. I mean, the shockwave came from past. If you would extend it in the back, which I have not done, it came from some place in scry minus, and then it went off to some place in scry plus. So there's a state, and the state has a history both in the past and the future, although I've not displayed it here. So this
is it important for the calculation what was before, or calculation is does not care about this component?
Well, in this we are not modifying the Hamiltonian anywhere except for the boundaries. So this is just a state of the theory, and there is an entire history that corresponds to the state. So you know, you could think of it that way, that it's because you prepared the state in some way at scry minus, you know, the observers knew about it in that way. So it's a state, and if that's what you're trying to get at, you could think of it that way. The state was prepared in a certain way in scry minus, and that's what the observers took advantage of. But that being said, you know, in a non-gravitational theory, there would have been nothing that would have leaked out here.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Okay. So where was I? Yeah. So I was saying that you know, you might have thought that maybe in a gauge theory you could have played the same trick, but in fact that's not true. And that's not true because non-gravitational gauge theories do contain exactly local gauge invariant bulk operators. One such operator is just trace of f squared. So you know, if you said these observers can't measure gravity and they can just measure, you know, they're living in a gauge theory, then they would be completely out of luck because you know there's nothing they could do to distinguish the vacuum from the vacuum after you acted in it with this unitary local operator. Because this local operator would leave every correlation function they could measure entirely unchanged in this range minus infinity to minus one over epsilon. Okay. So another thing I think that's important is, this is also something that's a quantum mechanical correlator. And you can see that by replacing, this is the only part in the talk where I'll keep factors of edge bar. You can just see that by restoring factors of edge bar and C. And in particular, you know, in the classical theory, there's a Birkhoff's theorem. The Birkhoff's theorem tells you if you look at two different shock waves which have, you know, the same energy, then that's all you can tell from infinity if they're spherically symmetric. But this is not a classical calculation, and it's important that these are quantum mechanical correlation functions. And so in the quantum theory, these correlators have more information about the state than they have in the classical theory. And you can see this explicitly. So as I said, if you take either G Newton to zero or if you take h bar to zero, the usual notions of information localization are recovered, and these experimenters are out of luck, and they cannot determine what the profile of the shock wave is. Okay, let me just say one more thing using the same example. Now, sometimes people say, you know, what if you had a global symmetry in the theory? Okay. So there are, of course, many proposals that say that maybe quantum gravity does not have global symmetries, but say that you did have a global symmetry and you had two kinds of shock waves, the blue shock wave and the green shock wave. Which were made up of identical fields, which were related by a global symmetry O1 and O2. And here are these two states, F1 and F2. Right? So these two states, you might have thought, have the same gravitational tails. And you know, you might have said, you know, can the observers distinguish between these two states? And the answer is yes, and it's pretty simple. It's the fact that, you know, in the state F1, if they measure the correlation function of this metric and the insertion of the field O1, they get the result that I showed in the previous slide, which is not zero. On the other hand, in the state F1, if they measure the correlator of this metric and the field O2, then they find the answer is zero up to order lambda. There are order lambda square corrections, which we don't care about for our discussion now. And the converse in the state F2. In the state F2, this correlation function of M O1 is zero, but the correlator of MO2 is not equal to zero. And so you see, the reason for this is that the operator that flips the blue and the green, which is the operator which, you know, pulls out, it's U dagger or U1 dagger U2, that operator does not commute with the Hamiltonian, because it's you know, because even though you might have thought that it's changing one state with another state, because it's trying to create a localized excitation, it has to be made up of a superposition of different energy states. And for this reason, you know, it changes these correlators of MO1 and MO2. Okay, most of this talk, you know, since I'm interested in evaporating black holes, is about flat space, and that's the case which I'm most interested in. But I should say that one can use very similar arguments in asymptotically ADS space. And there the result that one finds is that asymptotic correlators on an infinitesimal time band on the ADS boundary. So ADS, one way to think of it is in terms of a cylinder, and there's a conformal boundary of ADS. The conformal boundary is just the boundary of the cylinder. And the result is that asymptotic correlators in an infinitesimal time band from t equal to zero to epsilon completely fix the bulk state. And this is in contrast to a non-gravitational theory where you would need asymptotic correlators on all the boundary. And even if you're looking perturbatively about empty ADS, you would need asymptotic correlators for at least the light crossing time of ADS, which in some units is pi. But as I said, gravity localizes information very differently. And this information is available in a thin band. And you can think of this thin band as being morally the same as the boundary of a Cauchy slice that runs through t equal to zero, although really the precise result has to do with the conformal boundary. I should say that from the point of view of ADS CFT, this is a trivial result. It's a trivial result because, you know, we know in ADS CFT that if you give me asymptotic correlators on a single time slice, you don't even need a time band, and that is sufficient to fix the state because the CFT lives in one lower dimension. But this result does not assume ADS CFT. Rather, it should be thought of in the same way as the result I mentioned in flat space, that if one assumes that the UV theory obeys certain assumptions, namely that the Hamiltonian is positive and that the vacuum can be picked out by a boundary term, then it shows that any gravitational theory or any UV completion of low energy gravity that obeys these assumptions must necessarily be holographic. Okay, good. So that was the first part of my talk. Let me now go on and say something about the implications of these results for black holes. Okay, so let me remind you first of what the information paradox is. So in many years ago, almost 45 years ago, Hawking found that after a black hole forms, so if you what I have here on the left is a Penrose diagram of the formation of a black hole. So here's some mass which collapsed and went into the singularity. Hawking found that after a black hole forms, there's a process just formed due to vacuum fluctuations at the horizon of the black hole that leads to pair creation at the horizon, and that leads the black hole to evaporate. And the important part of what we are discussing here is that, you know, Hawking argued that this pair creation or this radiation that emanated from a black hole was seemingly uncorrelated with the details of the initial state that made up the black hole. So this leads to an information paradox, because you could imagine two different stars. So here's star one, which collapses into black hole one. Here's star two, which collapses into a second black hole. But Hawking argued that this radiation that emanates from the black hole is uncorrelated with the initial state. And so in principle, if you wait long enough, you know, the energy has to be conserved. And so the black hole is emitting radiation. So the black hole will eventually just evaporate away entirely into radiation. But because the radiation, Hawking argued, is uncorrelated with the initial state, this would suggest that the radiation that you get at the end could be the same even if the stars that you started with were not the same. And this would mean, if this process could really happen, it would mean that the time evolution arrows could not be reversed. And this contradicts unitarity. In any unitary theory, you can always go forward in time or backward in time. And so this is a simple way of stating the information paradox. Here's a more formal way of stating the information paradox. Think back of this Penrose diagram of the black hole. One can extend this Penrose diagram to now think of the entire space-time, including the part where the black hole has evaporated. And then consider an interval of future null infinity that goes from some retarded time u up to u equal to minus infinity. Then Hawking's arguments imply that if you think of the entanglement entropy of this interval, that's S of u, then this entanglement entropy is, you know, always grows with u. Okay, that's the statement that the radiation that's coming out is thermal and doesn't know about the initial state. And so if you plot, the Hawking prediction for this entanglement entropy, Hawking didn't really frame things in terms of this entanglement entropy, but this is one way to, one implication of his arguments, is that if you plot this entanglement entropy, which I'll talk about many times in the remainder of the talk, as a function of the retarded time, it just keeps growing like this. Okay. Now, this is again a paradox because, you believe that if you recover the state that you prepared at scry minus and scry plus, then the entanglement entropy of the state at scry minus should be the same as the entanglement entropy of the state at scry plus. In particular, if you started with a pure state, which you could have done, you can form a black hole by the collapse of a pure state, then the final entanglement entropy should be zero as well. Okay, now, what I said before gives us, tells us that this can't be quite right. It tells us this can't be quite right because, information about the black hole microstate is always available outside with the right measurements. So if you make a Cauchy slice through the black hole spacetime, and you have observers outside who make the right measurements, they can always determine what's happening. So it cannot be that information is lost. There is a more formal way to state this resolution, and that is that by using the same techniques that I mentioned earlier, one can prove that this von Neumann entropy of this segment minus infinity to some point u is independent of the upper bound u. And you see that this is kind of obvious if all the information is available near the past boundary of future null infinity. That's because if all the information is available here, for instance, if the state is pure, if the state is not pure, state has some entropy, you already know from the algebra of observables here what the state is. And therefore, you get no further information, and nor do you lose information as you go forward in future null infinity. And so you get this constant curve for the von Neumann entropy. I emphasize that this doesn't assume holography, but it's something that one can prove starting with the results that I mentioned. And so this tells us that the Hawking result cannot be correct. So as I said, this result that one has for the von Neumann entropy contradicts the argument or contradicts Hawking's suggestion that the entropy should grow monotonically. Now one might ask that, you found one answer, Hawking found another answer, but why is it that your answers differ? What is the error in Hawking's argument? And people say that, if you wanted to understand or resolve Hawking's paradox, you must also explain what the precise error in Hawking's argument is. So let me try and describe Hawking's argument in a little bit more detail. Okay. So the first thing to realize is that the actual computation that Hawking did was that of low point correlation functions. So Hawking really computed, if you have a black hole which emits some particles, what Hawking computed was the occupancy of these particles at future null infinity, and he found that this occupancy was thermal. But in fact, this by itself is not enough to lead to a paradox, and that's because typical pure states are exponentially close to mixed states. So, if you take a typical pure state and you look at the expectation value of any observable, that's exponentially close to the trace in the microcanonical ensemble of that same observable, even though the microcanonical ensemble is a mixed state and you have on the left-hand side a pure state. So the fact that you computed some two-point correlators or, four-point or six-point correlators cannot be used to conclude that the final state is mixed unless you keep track of exponentially precise corrections. So in fact, Hawking was aware of this issue. And so Hawking provided an argument to suggest that his conclusion was robust against small corrections. And this argument invoked what he called the principle of ignorance. And in fact, if one looks at Hawking's paper, the principle of ignorance, even though it's underplayed in future descriptions of the paradox, was very important in the original paper. It's a very important part of the argument. And it was meant to say that the conclusion that he had, couldn't be fixed by just adding some small corrections. And let me just read out on the left-hand side, I have an extract from Hawking's paper. It's a little small, so I'll just read it out. So what Hawking said is that, about every black hole, one has to introduce a hidden surface. And then, we should apply the principle of ignorance to say that all field configurations on the hidden surface, by which he means the interior of the black hole, are equally probable, provided they're compatible with the conservation of mass and angular momentum and charges that you can measure outside. And then he went on to explicitly introduce a factorization of the Hilbert space. So he said, if H1 is the space of possible initial data, and let H2 be the space of data on the hidden surface, and H3 the space of data outside, then he said a basic assumption of quantum theory is that the Hilbert space factorizes into H2 times H3. And then for the observer outside, you know, because you're ignorant of the state on the hidden surface, one must trace over all possible states inside the black hole up to some conservation of global charges, and then therefore obtain a mixed state outside. But you see that this is explicitly the assumption that the Hilbert space factorizes up to a few global constraints imposed by the Noether theorem. But while this is correct in the classical theory, this is simply incorrect. It's demonstrably incorrect in the quantum theory. So if one asks where is the error in Hawking's argument, one can point to this paragraph and say, look, here is the error in Hawking's argument, where there is an explicit assumption of factorization that is made to justify the result that the final state is mixed. Okay, more recent, there has been, of course, much discussion of the information paradox, but more recent refinements of the information paradox once again assume the split property, as I will try and explain. So one refinement, an important refinement, was made by Samir Mathur in 2009, and then elaborated by AMPS in 2012 in the firewall paper. And that went as follows. So Mathur and AMPS said that, you know, if you think of a black hole, evaporating black hole, and think of this nice slice that runs through the black hole, and one can divide the nice slice into three parts, one region just outside the black hole, one region just inside, and one region far away. And then Mathur and AMPS argued that if the horizon is smooth, then it must be the case that the entropy of A and B together is smaller than the entropy of B itself. That's the statement that, you know, the radiation outside is entangled with some partners inside. And furthermore, if the entropy decreases at late times, then it must also be the case that the early radiation is entangled with the late radiation, which is the statement that SAC together is smaller than SC, S once again being the entanglement entropy of these regions. And these two inequalities contradict what is called the strong subadditivity of the von Neumann entropy, which is the statement that SAC plus SAB must always be greater than or equal to SC plus SB. And you see that if these two are taken together, this is just in contradiction with strong subadditivity. And both Mathur and AMPS wanted to get rid of this first inequality, and one would like to say that, you know, there must therefore not be a smooth horizon for a black hole. But you see, this whole, the notion of strong subadditivity makes sense if the Hilbert space factorizes into factors associated with A, B, and C. But the Hilbert space, as we said, does not factorize in a theory of gravity. Now, it cannot be written as HA times HB times HC times something which is the complement of them. And therefore, you know, one should not apply the strong subadditivity of the von Neumann entropy. In fact, one should recognize that the information about A and B is already present in C. And therefore, you know, that resolves these paradoxes as well. And it's once again, the error is in the assumption of the split property, or the assumption that the Hilbert space factorizes. Okay, let me now turn to more recent developments. And I'm sure some of you noticed when I was drawing this figure for the von Neumann entropy, that this result is also different from the result from the conventional Page curve. So you see that I said that the von Neumann entropy at null infinity was just a constant, and that's different from what is sometimes called the Page curve, which is the statement that the von Neumann entropy is expected to first go up and then come down in this tent-shaped manner on null infinity. So why is the answer that we have different from the Page curve? In fact, it's the same reason once again, that if one looks at the calculation that Page performed. I'm sorry, Latham, is there some delay in what I'm saying, or is my audio and video still clear?
Sorry, yeah, I think it's clear.
Okay, fine, great, thank you. So so once again, the reason we obtain a different answer from the answer that Page had is once again that the calculation that Page had once again assumed factorization. So if one looks at Page's paper, what Page's paper said is, you know, if one takes a big Hilbert space, which is comprised of two subsystems, one of dimension M, the other of dimension N, then you can prove that the entropy of each subsystem is just given by log of M. And so this is once again the assumption that you have two factorized parts of the Hilbert space. And as a result, it is the case that non-gravitational systems must obey a Bethe curve. But when one applies this argument to gravity, and this is once again an extract from Bethe's paper, Bethe explicitly assumed that the black hole system, you know, you have a black hole system and you have a radiation system, and the black hole system has dimension n and the radiation system has dimension m, and these subsystems together form a total system in a pure state in a Hilbert space. But since, as we've now said many times, the Hilbert space for a black hole spacetime does not factorize in this manner, it is not surprising that the entropy at Scry plus does not follow a Bethe curve, because the assumption that the Hilbert space does factorize fails in a theory of gravity. Okay, at this point, let me pause to address a question that perhaps some of you already have. You see, we live in a world where gravity is presumably quantized, right? But why? But we still say, or at least I would like to say, that, you know, we do expect a Bethe curve for ordinary thermodynamic systems. If you look at coal, or, you know, you have some qubits, and you do expect a Bethe curve. But I told you that all the information is available outside. So why do I say that one should see a Bethe curve for ordinary thermodynamic systems, but not for black holes? So the reason is quite simple. The reason is that, you know, to see a Bethe curve, you need to keep track of effects of size e to the minus s, so of order e to the minus s. And that's because, as I said, typical pure states differ at this magnitude. So if you need to differentiate between pure states and mixed states, you need to keep track of effects of size e to the minus s. Now, for ordinary systems, it is possible to work in a limit where you take g Newton times the typical energy scale of an excitation in the system to zero, but you keep the degeneracy of microstates finite. So said another way, for ordinary systems, there's an obvious protocol for co-screening where one keeps track of effects of size e to the minus s, where s is the degeneracy of microstates of the system, but one ignores all of these unusual effects of localization in gravity that I was discussing, because all of those effects are suppressed by a factor that's controlled by g Newton times e to the d minus 2. And so, you know, one can just forget about those effects. You can just keep track of observables to a lower level of accuracy and still see a Bethe curve. But you see that for black holes, this is much more tricky. And the reason is that if you take E to be the energy of the Hawking quantum, then you find that G to the D minus 2 is 1 over S. So one cannot take, you know, this G E to D minus 2 to 0 while keeping track of effects of size E to the minus S, because if you in that limit, S diverges. Okay? So for a black hole, there is no obvious way, as there is for other non-gravitational systems, to keep track of effects of size e to the minus s, but forget about the unusual localization of information in gravity. And that is why for black hole evaporation, these effects that I was describing about the failure of the split property are important. Those effects are also true for other systems like a lump of coal or for qubits, but there's a sense in which we can forget about them, which one cannot do for black holes. Okay, let me just summarize once again. So, there's of course one thing which one can do for black holes as well, which is one just keeps track of very co-screened observables, which is just few point correlators of light fields. And if one does that, then, you know, one doesn't see the Bethe curve, one just sees the thermodynamic entropy. Alternately, one can keep track of fully fine-grained observables, which is all asymptotic correlators. And then, as I said, one finds all information at all times. And perhaps there is some intermediate set of observables which one can keep track of. And in our papers, we discuss some possibilities for this, so that you see the Bethe curve, so that first you lose information and then you regain the information. But it's not clear, you know, whether this is directly relevant to the information paradox or whether the set of observables is particularly natural. But to be clear, I'm not saying that such a set does not exist. But it's something that needs to be established, and there are some natural possibilities for such a set. But in these two natural limits, where you either keep track of very coarse-grained observables or fully fine-grained observables, this is the answer that you get. Okay, let me just spend the last few minutes talking about recent computations of the Bethe curve and just relating what I said to those computations. So of course, as I'm sure many of you are aware, there have been recent computations of the Bethe curve. The point I'd like to make is that these computations do not contradict our results. And the reason they don't contradict our results is that these models that are used to compute the Bethe curve involve non-standard theories of gravity. And these theories are non-standard in two ways. The first is that gravity in these systems is necessarily non-dynamical in part of space. So these systems necessarily involve a non-gravitational path. So there's gravity which is dynamical in some part of space, and then gravity switches off in some other. So in this cartoon, it's dynamical in this purple part and it switches off in this pink part. And the second way in which these systems are non-gravitational is that the graviton has a mass, and therefore these theories do not have a Gauss law. And therefore, what I've been saying so far does not apply to these theories. So let me just emphasize these two points in turn. So the first point is that, as I said, in these theories, one takes a theory of gravity in ADS and then couples it to a non-gravitational path. But this entire system has an entirely non-gravitational description, which is in terms of a CFT on a space with a boundary, which is called a BCFT. And the page curve that is being computed is really the page curve of information transfer between two parts of this non-gravitational system. So one makes some imaginary interface where you see this dashed line and then computes information transfer across that imaginary interface. And in fact, one can see, and this was the first paper we wrote with the group of seven, is that if one turns on even weak gravity in the bath, the page curve vanishes. So it's important that these calculations are computing some quantity that has a clean interpretation as something that's genuinely gravitational. So the words that accompany the computation says that this is the page curve of Hawking radiation, but really it is the page curve of one part, one subregion in the non-gravitational BCFT with another subregion in the non-gravitational BCFT. And so that's not in contradiction with anything I was saying, because in this setup in the BCFT, it's clear the Hilbert space does factorize. And so one should expect a page curve. Okay, there's one more point that's important. In these computations, a very interesting technique called the island proposal has been developed. But one of the consequences of the island proposal is that it suggests that in the region where gravity is dynamical, there is an effective factorization of the bulk Hilbert space into a part corresponding to the island and a part corresponding to the complement. But in fact, one can show, even without using all the results that I said, that right in perturbation theory, in a theory where the Gauss law applies, and the island proposal would be inconsistent. And the reason this works is for the same reason that the simple perturbative calculations that I mentioned earlier work. See, the black hole is a complicated non-perturbative state, but in some ways, it is very simple. And those ways are that if you look at late times, then correlation functions in the black hole background become time independent. On the other hand, if you create an excitation inside this island and you're allowed to use the Gauss law, then you find that that does induce some time dependence in the correlation functions. And in particular, it changes the correlator of the Hamiltonian and the insertion of the same field outside. This is a very similar calculation to the one that I was displaying earlier. And it gives you some result at leading non-trivial order in perturbation theory. This doesn't actually mean that there's anything wrong with the island computations. And the reason is that almost all computations of islands have been performed in massive theories of gravity where the Gauss law does not apply. So just for the experts in the audience, let me explain why these theories are massive, why a non-gravitational bath necessarily comes with a mass for the graviton. See, one way to think of these models is that, one can think of an ADS space with a black hole without any non-gravitational bath. And then in the second step, one couples it to a non-gravitational bath. Now, before one coupled the black hole to a bath, there was a stress tensor on the boundary of ADS, which was conserved. After one couples it to a bath, by construction, the stress tensor on the boundary of ADS is not conserved because, by construction, one wants energy to leak out from ADS. But you see, in conformal representation theory, the statement that the stress tensor is conserved is the statement that the stress tensor lives in a short representation of the conformal algebra. The statement that it is not conserved is the statement that it now lives in a long representation and has therefore picked up an anomalous dimension. If the stress tensor picks up an anomalous dimension, that corresponds in the bulk to the fact that the graviton picks up a mass. The mass of the graviton is very important, and one can see that in a very simple way, just by thinking of the linearized theory. It's important because if you think of the massless theory of gravity, so I'm just giving you the simplest example. If you think of the massless theory of gravity, you know, states in this theory must obey some constraint, which tells you that, you know, some derivative of the metric is equal to the energy density at any point. And if you just integrate both sides of this equation, you find that the integral of the energy density is given by the integral of this derivative of the metric, which is the total divergence. And so this just ends up being the integral at infinity of some component of some current that involves the metric, which is the ADM current. But in the theory of massive gravity, you find that this constraint now gets modified with the addition of this m squared term. And this left-hand side now is not a total divergence. And so the punchline is that in the theory of massive gravity, the Hamiltonian is not a boundary term, and the Gauss law does not apply. And if the Gauss law does not apply, neither does the holography of information. And in fact, although what I have on the screen is some toy example in linearized gravity, one can show in more detail that in the doubly holographic Karl-Crandall models that are most commonly used to study islands, islands are explicitly consistent. Okay, so I'm done. Let me just summarize what I said. The main point of my talk was that if you look at standard theories of gravity, they store information very differently from local quantum field theories. This is a non-perturbative result, which one can derive because it relies only on weak assumptions about the full UV theory of gravity. But the interesting part is that it's not just some, you know, abstract non-perturbative result, which is of no relevance, but rather it's something that can be verified concretely in perturbation theory. And this sheds light on why gravitational theories are holographic. If one accounts for this unusual localization of information, this helped to resolve several paradoxes about black holes. And forgetting about this property of gravity, which is a very natural thing to do because it's such an unusual property, and assuming the factorization of the Hilbert space is a recipe for paradoxes and has often led to paradoxes. The idea that the entropy of Hawking radiation obeys a Page curve also involves an assumption of factorization. But of course, there have been recent computations of the Page curve, but these involve massive gravity and a non-gravitational path where the Hilbert space does factorize. And so that's not in contradiction with anything I said in this talk. Okay, so thank you for your attention. I'll stop here.
All right, that was a wonderful colloquium. Thank you very much. So feel free to unmute to applaud user. And let me start by asking if there are any questions from students. Any students who would like to venture a question? Okay, if not, are there any other questions? Oh, Charlie, do I see, are you about to venture a question? No, okay. Any other questions? Yes, sorry, I didn't see who went first, but let's start with Manu.
Thank you for the wonderful colloquium. I just wanted to ask that according to what you said overall, it means that the information is already available outside. So do you think that means is there a way to access that information once the black hole has evaporated at late time?
So the information is always available at infinity. It's available early on, and it's available later as well. Of course, it requires non-perturbative accuracy to access the information. But the information is, the point of what I was saying was if you go to the boundary of a Cauchy slice, that information is always available. Maybe one setup where you can make what you're asking more precise is if you think of what's called a small black hole in ADS. So, if you think of a small black hole in ADS, just from the point of view of ADS CFD, which is more familiar, a small black hole in ADS is, you can think of it by crashing two blue balls together, it forms some quark gluon plasma. And of course, information about this is always available on the boundary. It's also available later after the black hole evaporates. But perhaps you're asking about, whether it becomes harder or easier after the black hole evaporates. But so, that's a good question, whether in this case of ADS, whether it becomes smaller or whether it becomes harder or easier after the black hole evaporates. If you use naive thermodynamic arguments, it always becomes harder and harder to extract the information just because of the second law of thermodynamics. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we have a precise understanding of that question. It's certainly true that if you measure all asymptotic correlators, the information is always available outside. It's an interesting question of, how you would exactly do state tomography in some non-perturbative system, to which there isn't a good answer. Maybe one could hope to find an answer for small black holes in ADS, but I don't know it, and I don't think it's known yet.
Thank you.
Eric?
You showed a Penrose diagram that showed a black hole with a singularity. If you assume a quantum theory, there might not be a singularity inside the black hole, but something else, and there might not be an event horizon. Am I correct in assuming if that was the case, then your argument would still work because it does not rely on an event horizon?
Yes, indeed, it would still work. And that's because the argument was made on a Cauchy slice. So on a Cauchy slice, there is no singularity. You know, the argument was an argument about states and the importance of constraints on how information is localized in a state. So the argument can be made on a nice slice that runs through the background. So it does not, you know, the fact that there is a singularity at some point if you evolve the nice slice into the future, does not affect the validity of the argument.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. John, go for it.
Just to, first of all, comment, you're implying that information is globally available, black holes, globally available, not just local. So but I have a question regarding rather practical question. In the case of a star collapsing, as you approach, try the external observer, you have to distinguish between an external observer and one who's falling into the black hole at proper time. External observer has coordinate time. So as we know, for an external observer, as he tries to observe near the collapsing star, the relativistic time dilation effect, it diverges. So it means that the horizon is only formed at future null infinity. External observer never actually sees a horizon form. So how does this affect? Does this have any practical effect on your result?
Yeah, so thank you. Once again, I didn't quite understand the first part of your comment. I didn't say the information was globally available, but rather that it was available in the asymptotic boundary of a Cauchy slice. As I was saying in response to the previous question, you know, there is a horizon, but the horizon is some causal property of the space-time. What was important in my argument was how the constraints apply on a slice. So you're right, of course, that, you know, if from the point of view of effective field theory, the right correlators for an infalling observer are different. You know, the right variables are different, and they're different for an observer outside. But that does not affect the fact that if you take a Cauchy slice and you have some observers outside and they measure asymptotic correlators, those asymptotic correlators always have information. I mean, those correlators in principle can also tell you about the experience of the infalling observer because they have all information about what's happening on the Cauchy slice, which is sufficient to reconstruct the experience of an observer outside and an observer who's falling in. So maybe I didn't understand your question entirely, but you're right, of course, that there are these two different observers who should use different variables, but that doesn't have any bearing on the argument that I mentioned.
Yeah, so in effect, your result doesn't depend on the existence of a horizon.
Indeed, yes, it is independent of the existence of
a horizon. By the way, from a practical human point of view, if a 10 solar mass black hole, if you accept Hawking radiation, it takes about 10 to the power 67 years to evaporate, which is quite a long time.
Okay.
Also, from an external observer point of view, we can't really go and know what goes on inside the black hole ever, unless you fall into it, and I'm not willing to do so. By the way, I forgot to say, for primordial black holes, it's a different situation because they already come with horizons, or whatever. But no one's ever experimentally observed a primordial black hole.
You're absolutely right that these questions are formal and don't have any empirical relevance for solar mass black holes. As you said, the evaporation time for a solar mass black hole is 10 to the 67 years. Correspondingly, you know, if you wanted to measure these effects I was talking about, you would need to make measurements to an accuracy e to the minus 10 to the 77, because the entropy of a solar mass black hole is 10 to the 77. So you know, it's not, there's no claim that these things have any empirical relevance for solar mass black holes. You know, you might hope that in the future you would have a way of constructing models in some model of gravity where you could construct, or you could at least simulate much smaller black holes, you know, black holes which are maybe 100 times the Planck mass. And then some of these figures would become much more reasonable, and then these things would have empirical relevance. That's one thing. The second thing I would like to emphasize is at least the first part of my talk, which was about the holography of information, as I emphasized, has some consequences within perturbation theory. So you're right that, you know, the physics of black holes is inaccessible and seems extremely inaccessible because of some of the numbers involved. But some of the other things I mentioned about, you know, taking a shock wave and trying to determine it before the shock wave actually reaches you, those are things which, you know, are still inaccessible to current experiments, but are things which work at least perturbatively. So these are not non-perturbative effects. So, you know, one might hope that if one did find a way of simulating quantum gravity, those effects one could actually check, because those are perturbative effects and they're already interesting and tell us how gravity is so different from ordinary field theories.
So the Fourier transform in the curve space-time is not unique. So it's very observer dependent. So how does this affect your shockwave analysis?
So the shockwave I was talking about was at asymptotic, was at null infinity. So, you know, you might have something. So, well, there are two things. The shockwave example I gave was actually a perturbation about flat space. So that was a perturbative example. So, you know, there we just think of Minkowski space and think of a perturbation about that. And I was saying you could determine the profile of the shockwave before it actually reached you. So you could imagine doing an experiment where, you know, you had some set of detectors that were surrounding some region. And they were tasked with determining, you know, what was inside the region. So to a good approximation, everything is flat space. And then one is trying to see how gravity localizes information differently in the vicinity of flat space. You're right, of course, that in the black hole space-time, you know, there's curved space, which one can't ignore. But again, the results I had were at null infinity, where, you know, things simplify once again. And there is a good sense of, you know, asymptotically, things being asymptotically flat.
Okay, why don't we move to the last question from Charlie?
Thank you. Nice talk.
Yeah, thanks for the really nice talk. So I was just trying to think more about the fact that the information is completely localized on the at null infinity. And so I was trying to think about if in your model of gravity, for example, instead of a singularity, you had like a baby universe kind of pop off. Are you saying that the information, because you can't exactly draw a Cauchy slice in the future after the black holes evaporated and in this baby universe? And I'm trying to think about where the information of this sort of baby universe would live, because it's not clear to me it would still be at that like null infinity. Could you maybe talk about that? Like, would that violate your two weak assumptions, any theory of gravity that does that, or what's happening with that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it would violate the assumption. So if by baby universe you mean an entire new asymptotic region of space-time popping out, then that would violate you know, the assumptions that I had. So I was assuming in all the arguments that we had, we'd fix the asymptotics of space-time, and that was just fixed. So if you can have a connection through the black hole to just an entirely different asymptotic space-time, that would violate the assumptions that I have. It would lead to loss of information, but it would also lead to loss of other conserved charges, because, you know, you could throw in charge into the black hole and it could go into this baby universe. And so, you know, it would just lead to if that's the baby universe that you're thinking of. So it could, you would violate things which are even more basic than this. But it would certainly, you know, if you really allowed an entire new asymptotic region to form, then the results that I mentioned would not hold in that case. So there's an assumption that, you know, you don't form new asymptotic regions of space-time. The asymptotic regions are fixed once and for all. I don't know if that's what you had in mind.
Well, I guess one thing I'm trying to think about is, like, for the two asymptotic regions, if you just kind of treated them as like two disconnected spacetimes, for example,
right.
I feel like the information for the union of these two spacetimes would be in this boundary that you were talking about, but individually,
yes.
It's unclear to me where the information lives. And maybe that's just another property of the lack of localization, but would like the information of one be stored in the other or spread across both, or maybe that's too far beyond what you were talking about. I was just wondering.
No, I think it sounds reasonable that if you take the union of the two asymptotic regions, that would have information, or union of all asymptotic regions, that would have information about the entire spacetime, but no single asymptotic region would have information about the spacetime. There'd be information that would be spread across and might even involve, you know, correlations between the asymptotic regions. I mean, genetically would involve correlations between the asymptotic regions.
All right, wonderful. Well, that was a really great, stimulating talk. Thank you again, Suvrat, for staying up late to give it to us.